I'm Ashton Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. After a year of UK-US-EU armed genocide and NATO defeat in its proxy war on Russia through Ukraine, the global economic landscape is transformed. Most of the world now looks optimistically to the new BRICS world order as Western European economies collapse, and the US under Trump reportedly seeks to retrench. But what about one technological danger that could end not only the livelihoods of most on the planet, but life on Earth itself? Jim Rickards is back to give us a warning, detailed in his new book, Money, GPT, AI and the Threat to the Global Economy. He's a best-selling economics author, former Pentagon and US intelligence advisor, and current editor of the financial newsletter Strategic Intelligence. He joins me again from Albany in New York. Jim, thanks so much for coming back on. We've seen the horror of AI on warfare as millions are threatened by it in this region by the UK-US-EU armed weapons. So what is Money, GPT? In the title of your book, outlining a threat perhaps bigger than the threats we've seen all year in Ukraine and Gaza.
Yes, Afshin, that's exactly right. We're in the financial realm, although I do have a chapter on actually nuclear war fighting. But the point is, you know, AI, artificial intelligence, of course, GPT, generative pre-trained transformers. GPT is just a subset of AI. It's the part that's caught all the attention lately. You can give it a prompt. It'll write an essay. It'll write a book. By the way, I should issue a disclaimer. I actually wrote this book. It was not written by a computer. But computers can do that, and a lot of college kids are using it for term papers and so forth. So it's caught a lot of glitz, but it's really just a subset of AI. And the book does not bash AI. It's not an AI bashing exercise. It's very powerful. There's a lot of good that will come out of it, just in the pharmaceutical space. The biochemists look at molecular combinations that could treat or cure certain diseases, but there are billions of them, and you know, a lot of smart people in a room with lab equipment could only come up with so many, but artificial intelligence applications can do far more, far faster, and actually they've produced some combinations that look interesting. So some good is coming out of it already. And I talked about that just very briefly, but that's not what the book's about. In the book, I stick to my lanes, so to speak, which are capital markets, banking, and national security. So I look at AI as applied to those three areas. And I make the point, there's nothing new about AI. It's been around as science. It's been around since the 1950s. As logic, it's been around since Aristotle. I mean, Aristotelian syllogism is just looks like a couple lines of computer code, as a matter of fact. So, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, that was the Frankenstein's creature was arguably AI in the early 19th century. So it's been around. But what's new is that the processing power is much, much faster because NVIDIA and others, AMD, Intel and others, these semiconductor chips are orders of magnitude faster than what's come before. You need a lot of electrical power. It's an issue. But even Bill Gates wants to reopen nuclear power plants or three-mile islands so they can have enough electricity for all the computing power. But the third thing, and probably the most important, is what's called the training set. So these are learning models. These are models that are capable of learning facts and making connections on their own without a developer having to, download the information or create the code. Well, what do they learn?
Quick detour from imminent Armageddon to the wokeism that you explain in those language models that they use.
Sure, I have a whole chapter on bias, censorship, and confabulation. The word confabulation is just a fancy word for lying, but it's a kind of lying where you don't even know you're lying because you don't know what you're saying. But that's part of it as well. And I make the point that so you're training on materials. Okay, what are the materials? Well, it's the internet, basically. You can buy the entire internet. It's a billion pages or however many. A lot of developers don't need that much. They buy, however many terabytes they need. But the computers are going through that. They're looking for words that associate with other words. They're creating what they call clusters or clouds. And then when it produces speech or writing or just output, it can kind of speak in any language really, but it can speak, in my case, English, pretty grammatically. I read some of the output. It's not bad, but the problem is it can't think. There's nothing intelligent about artificial intelligence. It's all math. One of the problems we make is we anthropomorphize it. Because it can talk or have a pleasant voice like Siri or Alexa. We think it's our friend. It's not our friend. It's just a bunch of math. But having said that, recently Google unveiled their GPT app. It was called Gemini. And one of the users, early user, put in what's called a prompt, which is a question. And it said, please give me an image of a pope. And the computer came back with three images of women in papal vestments and a shaman. And then another user said, please give me an image of a Viking. And it came back with an African Viking. Well, I happen to be Catholic, and I happen to know that there have been 266 popes in 2,000 years, and they were all men. Now, whether you think that's a good thing or a bad thing, we can take that to the bar, but it's a fact that we've had 266 male popes, no female popes. If you've been to Scandinavia, they're fair-skinned and blonde. There were no African Vikings in the year 1000 AD. So people say, well, it's malfunctioning. It's producing, you know, kind of garbage output. They need to go back and fix it. And even Sergey Brin came out and said, yeah, we kind of blew that one. That's not true. It actually functioned exactly as it was designed. And that's the point. There was no bug, you know, buried in the layers of the model. It had a feature called prompt injection. What's prompt injection? Well, you give it a prompt, and instead of giving you a straight answer to a straight question, it will embellish the question to meet some politically correct or woke goal. So for example, you say, give me an image of a pope, and the computer reads it as, give me an image of a pope in a world where there's no sexual discrimination and everyone's treated equally. Well, if that's the question, you're going to get some female popes, but that wasn't the question. Same thing with the Viking. You know, if you say, give me a Viking, it'll say, give me a Viking in a world where, you know, all races come together, kumbaya, et cetera. Well, you might get a black Viking. But the point is, it's functioning perfectly, but it's not responding to your question. It's responding to an embellished question that incorporates woke activism, you know, et cetera.
I mean, those are humorous examples. But I mean, in scholarly research, this is catastrophic. You say in the book about a Ukraine essay, which you quickly identified as probably a result of ChatGPT, in Foreign Policy magazine, the catastrophically poor journal that the CIA and diplomatic wonks want to quote from.
Right. Well, you're right. I mean, the examples are very accessible, but they're real examples. But sure, apply it to anything. Apply it, and I make that point. So, who are the gatekeepers on GPT? Who are the gatekeepers controlling the output you or I or anyone else or any serious analyst would get using GPT? Well, we know who it is. It's OpenAI, which is Sam Altman. That's a private company. But it's Microsoft, Meta, which is Facebook, Alphabet, which is Google, Apple, and just a few others, or five or six gatekeepers. Now, what's their track record in coming up with the truth? Well, they lied about COVID. They lied about masks, which don't work. They lied about the vaccines, which are not vaccines. They're experimental gene modification therapies that also don't work. They lied about the war in Ukraine. I mean, Americans still think we're winning. Russia's winning decisively, and the NATO-backed Ukrainian forces are losing horrifically. They've had 500,000 dead. But average Americans, typical Americans, don't know that because our media lies about it, including Google search results. And they lied about climate change. So you have people, organizations, start with Google, but the other ones I mentioned, who have been lying to you for 5 years or longer about climate change, the war in Ukraine, the pandemic, and a lot else. But all of a sudden, we're supposed to believe them in GPT. So my point is, they've been lying to us all along. They're the gatekeepers on GPT. I would be extremely wary of taking anything that comes out of their GPT at face value. And then just to add to that, if you happen to be a subject matter expert, you can probably spot the falsehood. As there was an example with Ukraine, I'll turn to that in a second. You can probably spot the falsehood. But if you have to be a subject matter expert to spot the fallacies, then what good is it in the first place? But the real danger are the people who are not subject matter experts, who are relying on it for good information, who are being propagandized by the output. And that's just the one of many flaws and problems with the system that I point to. The example on Ukraine that you referred to, it was Foreign Policy magazine, and they did, you know, kind of an experiment. They created two essays, you know, fairly short, 900 words, on the origins of the war in Ukraine. One was generated by a computer, GPT. The other one was done by a bright high school student who was somewhat knowledgeable. And they were published side by side anonymously. And as a reader, you're supposed to look at them and see if you can pick the robot. I picked it in one sentence. I said, that's the robot. And then I read the rest of it. I read the other one. I said, that's the student. And I was right. But nothing was easier because it started with cliches one after the other. And, I'm a writer. You don't like cliches. I use them occasionally. A few of them come in handy. But it was cliche ridden. But that's how a computer, I won't use the word thinks, that's how a computer processes.
Russian aggression.
Looking at,
and things like that.
Yeah, exactly. If it's looking at 1,000 articles on Ukraine and it sees certain cliches over and over, it assumes that that's how you write. That's not how good writers write, but that's how a computer might write. So it was very easy to spot. But so there were two problems. Number one, well, I said, first of all, it was easy to spot the robot for the reason I mentioned, but neither the robot nor the student got it right because they completely ignored the 2014 coup d'etat, the 2008 declaration. In 2008, George Bush said Georgia and Ukraine should join NATO. 6 months later, Putin invaded Georgia. Okay, so were you not paying attention? Did you not understand that you had crossed a red line? You were threatening Russia's national interests. And then 2014, the CIA and MI6 ran a coup, deposed a duly elected leader. Okay, maybe he wasn't the most honest or popular guy, but he did win an election. And then 2 months after that, Putin took over Crimea. So it was what part of red line do you not understand? But they kept going and they kept going. And that was not mentioned in this essay. It really started with the special military operation in 2022. So the work was deficient by the human and the robot because it didn't really get to the roots. And B, the robot was easy to spot because it wasn't a very good writer. So it's interesting.
Although I don't know whether your ChatGPT, because it's giving South Ossetia autonomy, not invading Georgia. No, but this is the point. We can argue about different points, but if the AI is giving this information as truth and gospel based on lies, then the whole world is run on lies. Sorry to interrupt. I know we have to get through you so much, but you did mention an open AI, which I don't know whether it should be called closed AI, by Sam Altman.
Right.
You presumably are hugely relieved of a Trump victory then as regards Elon Musk's influence. Elon Musk has pointed to the dangers of this AI technology. Before we get to the themes in your book, I mean, you've got to tell me whether he's read your book.
I don't know if Elon has read it. I don't know if Trump has read it, but I do know I am in touch with people on the transition team. And it's created some interest. I will say a few things are more obnoxious than patting yourself on the back. But in my newsletter the week before the election, we said Trump in advance were going to win. We said Donald Trump was going to get 312 electoral votes, including Michigan, 54 Senate seats and 224 House seats. The actual result was 312 electoral votes. So we nailed that, stuck the landing. 53 Senate seats, so okay, off by one. And looks like 222 House seats, off by two out of 435. So it's literally the best prediction in the world. People like Nate Silver and the New York Times and the others were saying too close to call. The Economist said Kamala is going to win, et cetera. So you have to deal with all that. But we got it exactly right. But that's because we're using better models. It's not like we have more IQ points, but if you have better models, you're going to get better results. So it's a great outcome for the United States, in my view.
A break now. Amazing result, though. Jim Rickards, I'll stop you there. More from the former Pentagon advisor and best-selling author of Money, GPT, AI, and the Threat to the Global Economy after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with former Pentagon advisor and best-selling author of Money, GPT, AI, and the Threat to the Global Economy, Jim Rickards. Jim, you were talking to me about how your modeling showed who was going to win this year's presidential elections better than anyone else on Earth. I do want to get on to Armageddon. I keep interrupting because there's so many themes in there. While I can, I've got to mention the nuclear threat. You're a big fan of Charles Sanders Peirce and Russian Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov.
Yes.
Because of what he did in 1983. Just explain those two names and their significance in the book and to all our lives.
Sure. So I have a few chapters on capital markets, you know, market crash and a banking panic. And we talked about the bias. But I have a chapter on national security, but specifically about nuclear warfighting. Now, I started studying nuclear warfighting in 1969, and that was based on works of scholars, mostly done in 1959, in the early 1960s. It was Albert and Roberta Wolfstetter, Paul Nitze, Henry Kissinger, but maybe the biggest brain was Herman Kahn. And Herman Kahn, you know, basically said, here's how nuclear wars are going to start. Nobody's going to wake up on a sunny day and say, oh, nice day, I think I'll fire off a nuclear weapon. He developed what he called the escalatory ladder. It was actually a 54-step ladder. And he said, what happens is two antagonists, one does something provocative, the other one responds, you know, in a more aggressive way. The first party, you know, raises the ante, and you keep going, getting more and more you know, violent or confrontational. And you don't realize that you are climbing the escalatory ladder. You are climbing a ladder towards nuclear annihilation. By the way, there are two dynamics in the world today, right now, that are following the pattern that Herman Kahn outlined in the early 1960s. One is Ukraine. So again, without revisiting the whole history, you know, US sponsors a coup in 2014. Putin takes Crimea. We give weapons to Ukraine. Putin invades the Donbass. We start sending Bradley fighting vehicles and Abrams tanks and Attackman's missiles and Patriot missile batteries. And Russia comes back with, you know, Kinjal missiles, hypersonics, drones, and a lot more. Again, if you can debate the war, we can take that to the bar. But my point is that there's an escalatory pattern there. There's no question about it. Same thing in the Middle East. Again, starting with the massacre on October 7th, 2023, Israel invades Gaza. Hezbollah fires missiles. Israel attacks Hezbollah. Iran and Israel start shooting at each other. The Houthis close the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. Again, pick a side, argue the geopolitics of it, but there's no question that you're on an escalatory path. And there are nuclear powers all around. U.S., Russia, Israel is a nuclear power. Iran's not far away. And so you're on exactly the dynamic that Kahn described. Now, what was Kahn's advice? Kahn's advice said, first, three steps. First step, recognize that you're on the ladder. Don't engage in wishful thinking. Don't pretend otherwise. You are on that escalatory ladder. Number two, take a beat. Stop. Number three, climb back down. De-escalate. Find a way and back down that ladder so you don't get too close to nuclear annihilation. And of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis was the paradigmatic case. Now, between today, when we're on the ladder, and 1962, when we climbed down, there were two cases in the 1980s. One in particular, Russia actually had, well, Soviet Union at the time, but basically Russia, they had two forms of primitive AI. They were using AI at the time, and they had a system codenamed OCO, and it was designed to detect incoming U.S. ballistic missiles. And one day it did, this was 1983, it did, and actually gave a launch signal. It said, because the warfighting strategy is launch on warning. When the other side's shooting at you, don't wait until the missiles land. Launch your missiles right away so they're not destroyed on the ground. That's called launch on warning. So this gave a launch signal. Now, Lieutenant Colonel Stanislav Petrov saw this signal, and his orders were call his superiors, move it up the chain, in other words, and that could very well have resulted in the Soviet Union firing missiles at the U.S. But he had worked on the system. He had knew it had flaws, and he saw that there were five missiles coming in. And he said to himself, well, if the U.S. were attacking the Soviet Union or Russia, they wouldn't send five missiles. They would send 200 missiles. So it must be a mistake or false alarm. Turned out it was. It was the sun hitting the clouds in a certain way and reflecting in the radar and triggering a false alarm. But he disobeyed orders. He did not call his seniors. He waited it out, bet his life and his country that he was correct. And he was, and later became known as the man who saved the world. Another case, so just be brief, there was a U.S.-NATO war game going on at a time when the KGB had concluded that if the U.S. got sufficiently far ahead of Russia, they knew they were ahead, but if that gap widened and the U.S. had a, you know, economic, military, et cetera, superiority to a certain degree, they would be very likely to fire, basically do a nuclear attack. Well, the war game that NATO was conducting was a nuclear attack. It was a game, but that was what they were simulating. And the KGB saw that they concluded it was a front or a sham for an actual nuclear attack. They were getting their bombers ready, their missile silos prepared. And then it was Lieutenant General Petruz in the U.S. Army who saw this and de-escalated. He ordered the war game to take a pause and stop further action. The KGB picked up on it and they de-escalated, and that was that. So the point is, we had two near nuclear wars in the 1980s. Why didn't we go to nuclear war? Well, Lieutenant Colonel Petrov and Lieutenant General Perutz relied on gut instinct. They relied on their gut, their intuition, common sense. They disobeyed orders, they risked their countries, but they felt it was the right thing, and they were right. But my point is, AI cannot do that. That's called abductive logic. You know, we've had inductive logic, since David Hume, and deductive logic since Aristotle. But there's a third branch discovered or identified by Charles Sanders Peirce in the 19th century, called abductive logic. And there's, I don't want to digress into the whole essay on that. It's a big subject. He was the father of semiotics, which is the basis of philosophy today. But if you want to put it in plain English, it's common sense. It's gut instinct, okay. It's intuition, it's the things I mentioned.
Okay, you mentioned economic superiority. And of course, this is a big part of this book. I mean, clearly the AI there, when it comes to being in the military, is not safe. That's clear from the abductive reasoning that's required. But if the economy is still working by the time this interview is broadcast, because if you read your book, it could happen at any moment, the way right. flash crashes happen mean that everyone's livelihoods could be destroyed at a stroke if certain reforms that you recommend in the book are not made.
That's correct. And the point I make is that it happened. There's something called flash war. So I talked about the Cuban Missile Crisis played out over 3 weeks. The two issues I identified in the 1980s played out in a matter of a day, or in one case, a few weeks. But with AI and the nuclear kill chain on both sides, you could climb that ladder in minutes, and that could lead to nuclear annihilation. So my advice is pretty simple. Keep AI out of the kill chain. If you want to have it off to the side as some kind of analyst or something, fine, maybe. Be careful with it, but do not put it in the decision-making process or you will get those kind of results.
And just how do these flash crashes work right now using AI? They're using AI right now.
Right. Well, you're at a football game, and you don't have a very good view because the person in front of you is too tall or wearing a big hat or whatever. So you say, well, I have a solution. I'll stand up. And you stand up and you say, yeah, I can see everything. It's great. But what happens next? Well, the person behind you stands up and the person behind her stands up. And before long, the entire stadium is on their feet. And nobody's better off because, relatively speaking, you're the same. And everybody's worse off because you're standing. You're not sitting comfortably. That's called the fallacy of composition. And the idea is something that works for an individual. It's a good individual strategy. When you stood up, you could see better. Is catastrophic at scale. Now, let's take that over to capital markets. And how does that work? So you have a market crash. Again, not uncommon. We saw it in March 2020. Market fell 30% in 30 days. So what do people do? They watch it for a couple of days and they're like, you know what? I don't want to lose money. I'm out. They sell everything, go to cash, move to the sidelines, wait till the market hits bottom, and then they can tiptoe back in and catch the next wave up. That is a very good individual strategy. That's not a bad thing for a person to do. But what happens when everybody does it? You very quickly have all sellers, no buyers. You blow through the circuit breakers. You go through the floor, and the markets actually have to be closed. It's not even a matter of time out. You actually have to close the markets. And the point is that's an aspect of human behavior. It's why circuit breakers, so-called, were installed after the 1987 flash crash. But with AI, everything I just described happens, again, faster. It accelerates and it amplifies what would be human nature. So it's really the combination. It's human nature combined with the accelerant of AI that makes all this happen much faster than regulators realize. And the result is that, again, you can be wiped out. In effect, your exchange-traded equity that you think of as liquid turns into private equity. You still own it, but you can't trade it and you can't get cash.
And there's no regulation. So you recommend some kind of throttling of the market and other elements there. I've just got to, as we're running out of time, just ask you what your advice is. You see, some might see your advice as diversification as being a bit banal, but you believe that we live in very precarious economic times in late capitalism then.
Right. Well, I do advise diversification. It's a well, among academics and theoreticians, it's a well-understood strategy.
For those rich enough to be able to diversify, I should say, for viewers living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah, well, I was with a taxi driver in Las Vegas, and we got on the subject of gold. I think I was there to give a speech on gold. And she said, "What can I do?" And I said, "Well, you can buy one gold coin." You know, at the time it was about $1,200. I said, "Buy one gold coin, put it in a safe place, and that wealth will be preserved." So yes, the problem with diversification, you recommend, and people go, "Oh, I'm diversified. I own 50 stocks in 10 sectors, semiconductors, mining, consumer non-durables, et cetera." And I say, "No, you're not. You may own 50 stocks, but you're in one asset class, which is stocks, and they're all going to go down together." Real diversification means, and by the way, with specific reference to AI, non-digital assets. I'm not talking about cryptocurrencies. Stocks, bonds, commodities are all traded on digital ledgers. But things like gold, silver, land, fine art, natural resources, and if you like, private equity and venture capital, where you don't expect liquidity, you're in it for 5 to 7 years. So having that and a lot of cash, having that as some significant percentage of your portfolio, 30% or maybe more, if these flash crashes happen, and they will, I mean, it's just a matter of time, the rest of your portfolio will be preserved and your wealth will be preserved.
Jim Rickards, thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for the final show of this year. Money, GPT, AI and the threat to the global economy is out now. Our continued condolences to those suffering in the Holy Land this Christmas at the hands of UK-US EU armed genocide. We'll be back on Saturday, the 18th of January for a brand new season. Until then, we'll be airing your favourite episodes of this season every Saturday and Monday. Remember, you can still keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. We'll see you very soon and have a happy new year.